and Guatemala, and Guatemalans still suffer. Trump still blaming the Guatemalans for this U.S. policy that has forced people to migrate out of their countries, right? So Rigoberta Menchu, indigenous of Guatemala, who was, you know, the whole story behind her surviving.
Yeah. Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Yes, Nobel Peace Prize winner. And that story and that struggle continues, so it makes perfect sense that she's on the women's building.
She's at the very top of one of the sides, and the other side, the side where the entrance is actually at, is a woman that is in a position where you can see that she's about to give birth, and you could see that. It's amazing.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11 o'clock. Coming up next is the bike show, so stay tuned. But first, this from KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the MLK Dream Run Kickoff Celebration on Saturday, September 7th at 1 p.m. at the PCC Cascade Campus in Portland.
The MLK Dream Run Kickoff Celebration features music, theater, food, drink, dancing, and raffle prizes. There's also a vendor fair for the kickoff celebration to the MLK Run on Sunday, September 8th.
Again, that's the MLK Dream Run Kickoff Celebration on Saturday, September 7th from 1 to 8 p.m. at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus, located at 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio wants to hear from you, our dear listeners and members, about why you support KBOO, why you listen, and why others should support the radio station. Please call 503-231-8032, extension 302, and tell us your name, what KBOO means to you, and why do you continue to support KBOO. Again, that's 503-231-8032, extension 302. Thank you for supporting your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to the Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studio in Portland, Oregon. My name is Alon Robb, and with me in the studio is my co-host, April Streeter. Good morning, April. How are you today?
I'm really good, thanks.
Our engineer today is Claire Risciotto, and good morning to you, Claire, and thank you for engineering. Before we get to bicycles, I'd like to mention the climate strike, which does involve bicycles. On September 20th till the 27th, across the globe, activists, dreamers, people will join, letting the world know that we're not going to take it anymore. We're protesting the way things have been going as far as our planet. So those who are interested in joining, you could find many resources, many groups involved in Portland. Probably two of the main groups are Extinction Rebellion and 350 PDX. So that's the climate strike. In today's show, our guests are two poets, dreamers, and activists who gather and create stories while riding their bicycles.
In the first half of the show, we will talk with sound artist, poet, and storyteller Devi K. Lockwood, who cycled around the world collecting 1,001 stories about water and climate change from the people she meets. In the second half, our guest will be writer and poet Matthias Svalina, creator of the Dream Delivery Service. With no intention to replace the postal service, at least not yet, Matthias writes dreams every day and delivers them by bike to his subscribers before dawn.
And before we introduce our first guest, a few news items from across the cycling universe. The first one is from Egypt, comes from the publication EgyptianStreets.com. The publication reports that the country's Ministry of Sport has declared a new initiative called A Bicycle for Every Citizen, aiming at promoting a healthier, more active lifestyle for Egyptians and reducing pollution. The plan calls for selling citizens bicycles at a price below their market price. Payments will be accepted in installments in cooperation with banks and bicycle companies. The initiative will start in the crowded capital city of Cairo and also in Giza, and then spread across the land. Egypt has a long and rich cycling history going back to the days it was ruled by the Ottomans and the British, but these days the number of cyclists is small. In the last several years, more cycling events have been held, bike lanes have been installed in several Cairo neighborhoods, and the country's president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, has participated in rides.
And as reported in the French media, the Paris municipality has unveiled a plan to make Paris the cycling capital of the world within a year. The plan, which allows a citizens' consultation that has garnered more than 7,000 comments, calls for an investment of more than 150 million euros. The city council aims to triple the number of bicycle trips in Paris to increase their share from 5 to 15% of the total journeys made. This will entail doubling Parisian cycle lanes from 700 kilometers currently to 1,400 kilometers. Christophe Nadovsky, Paris deputy mayor in charge of transport, has said that to combat cyclists' sense of vulnerability, the municipality plans to create two-way bike lanes and limit car speeds to 30 kilometers per hour. 10 million euros of the 150 will be used to help Parisians purchase scooters and cargo bikes. We have a lot of work to do to get to our goal, but we are hopeful, concluded Nadovsky. Back to you, Alon.
Okay, and our first guest today is Devi Lockwood, a multimedia journalist, writer, explorer, traveling the world to document the 1,001 human voices on water and climate change. Devi has written,
"Our voices, our stories matter. I'm out to document the beautiful and terrifying complexity of this time of transition. The solutions are as vast as the problems and the questions themselves. If I can be one tiny piece of forging a better world, then I will have done something worthwhile. In cycling and in listening, I found a way that I could to contribute to the well-being of the planet, to act in service of this gorgeous world I call my home."
Thank you, Devi, for these beautiful words and sentiments, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Where does this find you today? Where are you as we're speaking?
Yeah, so I'm actually working at the New York Times opinion desk right now. Kind of had a sideways path into journalism for the next year or so, and I am at our offices in New York City.
Awesome.
Okay. A paper that I read every day, so I'll look for your writing in it. Before we get to your wonderful project, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe some of your early cycling memories, your background?
Sure. So my grandfather taught me how to ride a bicycle when I was 8 years old, and it was the most terrifying and then freeing thing I think I had ever done with my body up until that point. And I was an athlete in college. I was on the rowing team, but ended up tearing my ACL partway through the summer between sophomore and junior years, playing pickup soccer with some friends. And then riding the bike went from being this thing that I did kind of just to get around as an act of convenience to being something I really actively fell in love with, and was kind of the first way that I could move after that surgery. And so when I was doing all the rehab and recovery on my knee, I wanted a goal and decided that I wanted to ride my bike partway down the Mississippi River the next summer. And so I did that. And along the way, I recorded audio stories from people I met for my senior thesis. And I was studying folklore and mythology at the time. And the farther down the river that I rode my bike, the more stories people were telling me about the impacts of water and climate change in terms of intensified saltwater encroachment on the land, or storms that meant that people were kind of making the difficult decision of leaving places that they had called home for generations. And then once I started listening to these stories, I really didn't want to stop. I applied for funding to travel for a year after that, and was really fortunate to get a grant from Harvard for a year of purposeful wandering after graduation. And then once I got started, I really didn't want to stop. This was in 2014 that I began. So I started with the People's Climate March in New York City, and then traveled a little bit without the bicycle in Pacific Islands in Fiji and Tuvalu. And then I started riding my bicycle in New Zealand, took a cargo ship to Australia, and cycled up the East Coast, then was back in New Zealand, then cycled throughout Southeast Asia and Thailand, Laos and Cambodia, and then came home for a bit. And then since then, I've been traveling a little bit more without the bicycle, but riding the bike is still my favorite way to get around.
Okay, so that then, those travels, that formed the bulk of the research that you did, or the collecting of stories that is that you call the 1001 Stories Project?
Yeah, exactly. And so to date, it's been about 850 stories and counting.
Okay.
Next November, the plan is to continue in Antarctica with support from the National Science Foundation Antarctic Artists and Writers Grant. So kind of firming up the details, but there's some really fascinating research going on down there, and that's the only continent where I haven't recorded stories yet. It's the hardest one to get to.
Okay. I do have a question that's maybe I hope our listeners are interested in hearing about, and that is a little bit more about the logistics of that travel. So I do know what it means to travel by bike and have your panniers and take your stuff with you, but you're doing something that's a little beyond my scope of travel, and I guess I'm most interested in how you self-supported. Was it all through grants, or did you do anything else? And how you moved your bike from place to place when there were oceans or big bodies of waters or a lot of places where you couldn't cycle, how you got your bike to the next place?
Yeah, so I have to say it's like 5 years of journeying and probably 2 years of that solidly on the bike, and so my strategy's changed a little bit over mm-hmm. time. But it's actually really easy if you're flying, which is not the best way to travel in terms of carbon intensivity, but for flying, it's really easy to travel with the bike. There's bike shops pretty much anywhere in the world that have extra cardboard boxes that they get their bikes that they sell shipped to them in. And so like when I was flying from Phnom Penh back to the States, for example, went to a bike shop there, asked if I could have one of their old bike boxes and some of the pieces of padding to put around it. And then I go on the bicycling magazine website to watch a video tutorial they have.
Okay.
I forget about just how to disassemble the bike and put it in the box. But then it's, some airlines have an extra charge of about $100. Some of them don't. And they just treat it like an extra large piece of baggage. When I was crossing the Tasman Sea between New Zealand and Australia, I took two different cargo ship trips, and that was a bit more logistically complicated. I mean, easy to arrive at a port and just wheel the bike up the ramp and on the boat, but cargo ship trips are really expensive. It's about $200 US a day, which
wow.
ended up being 5 to 6 times the cost of what it would be to fly. So I crowdfunded that on Kickstarter and wrote people poems and postcards from the boat, which was super fun. In terms of supporting myself monetarily, so the grant I got from Harvard, I mean, it's just a huge privilege, and that was $22,000 US, which was way more than I needed to live just on the bike. And I have to say, a lot of people took me in too. I stayed with a whole bunch of warm showers hosts, and camped. I was raised by a mountaineer, so traveling with a tent and sort of pitching a tent wherever was second nature to me. And then a lot of people took me in, which I think is one of the benefits of traveling as a solo female. People are really quick to trust me, which was just this huge act of kindness. I don't think I would have been able to go for as long as I did on the bike without all of that generosity from people around the world.
And as you travel, how do you meet the people you're interviewing? Do you have a sign? Do you just talk to people? How does it work, let's say, in New Zealand?
Yeah. So New Zealand was unique because it's kind of a small country in terms of the human population. And so once I met people kind of in Auckland, they introduced me to their friends in other parts of the island, who then introduced me to other people who I should talk to. So it's kind of this whisper network. But I also have a cardboard sign. So it's tell me a story about water on one side and tell me a story about climate change on the other. And that can be a really good conversation starter when I'm not on the bike, for just walking around and talking to people.
And so tell us about the importance of these stories that you did collect for others who might want to go and to the website and experience some of that. What was your feeling, and also if that changed over collecting stories, of the importance of what you were doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm still grappling with that, and there's still only a few of them up online from the archive that there is there. But I think one of the things that's really important to think about with climate change, I mean, often it's easy to think about something as large and complicated as climate change in terms of the numbers, in terms of degrees of temperature change, or inches of sea level rise. And what I was really trying to do in this project is get people to think about the human impact of what it feels like to live in a place where the water level has risen, and in places like Pacific Islands, like Tuvalu, that has really dramatic implications for drinking water. Mm-hmm. And when there's not enough water to drink, you have to have really make really difficult decisions about how to allocate that water, and that impacts people's lives. And so things like that, just kind of putting human stories in dialogue with one another, that form the backbone of what I was trying to do.
Okay.
And I like your idea of having your choice of 1,001 stories, you know, with a connection to the Arabian Nights and Shahrazad surviving for as long as she could tell her story, and her keeping herself alive also keeps other women alive so the king doesn't murder them. I'm wondering if you feel like that stories could save lives. Can they stop the destruction of the planet, or is that too presumptuous?
No, I hope so. it's kind of part of the work that I do now as a journalist too, is trying to, as an editor here at the opinion section, amplifying people's voices that wouldn't otherwise be heard, and bringing some of those voices that we really need to hear about climate change and other issues as well into the forefront of the conversation. But my hope is that, yeah, stories can change the world. And that listening really at its core is an act of love. And in order to create solutions that work for everyone and that are, you know, elevating people and solving other social justice issues at the same time, I think that's the great, like, climate change is a huge danger, but it's also a huge opportunity to rethink how we relate to one another and who benefits in a society and who has opportunities to move forward. My hope is that climate solutions can also address other issues that we live with.
And when you look back on your travels, do you have any highlight or lowlight that would be interesting for our listeners?
I think a highlight for me was crossing up and over Arthur's Pass in New Zealand. I don't have the exact numbers of how tall it was and how steep it was, but it was a very long and arduous climb. And I ran out of food partway up.
Oh, no.
Stopped at a gas station, and the only thing that looked palatable to me there was this big thing of, they weren't gummy worms, they were like gummy vampire teeth. And so I was sitting out front, and there were these like two guys drinking a beer and talking to each other, and I was just like, you know, inhaling, as get super hungry riding a bike all day, right, inhaling this bag of gummy teeth. And then they looked at me and they're like, you're not gonna make it up this hill, this is the steepest part ahead. And I'm like, yes I am. They're like, well, if you need help, just roll back down and we'll take you up in our truck. And I'm like, no, I'm gonna do it. So I kept climbing, and, you know, passing like over this aqueduct and all of this water rushing around me that I could hear from these waterfalls, and it was beautiful but hard. And there were cars that were going up and down, and they would roll down their windows and cheer me on. And when I finally got to the top of the mountain, I mean, it's just so gorgeous, the view, but I also felt this like incredible sense of accomplishment. And I jumped off my bike and picked a flower and put it behind my ear and then did a little happy dance. And since then, that's been my ritual. When I get to the top of a mountain that I didn't think I could climb, or when I do something that I didn't think I could do, I like make sure to take time to enjoy having gotten there, because it's so, so satisfying. Yeah, that was a really fun highlight.
Okay, so you didn't faint right after you did the happy dance of hunger and dehydration?
Well, I did the happy dance of hunger and dehydration, but then, like, was trying to make it to a friend of a friend's house, and I was so disoriented that I ended up, like, cycling partway down the hill on the other side and then having to come back up that.
Oh,
and
no.
I was a little mad at myself after that, but it was funny. There was a sense of humor in it, and I think we had a really lovely meal that night. So
okay.
It was good after that.
And you are listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon. In the studio are April Streeter and Alon Robb, and we are speaking with Debbie Lockwood about her powerful project of 1001 Stories About Water and Climate. You know, Debbie, looking at your website, it seems like there are people like Franny Canetti lives in the Mississippi Delta and is affected by the rising water and still, you know, acts and remains optimistic. And you also describe a man in New Zealand who worked in the fracking industry and acknowledges that there is a climate catastrophe. I'm wondering if, you know, do you get depressed when you interview people or in your travels, or what gives you hope?
I don't know. I wouldn't say that I ever really find listening to people depressing. I think it's just endlessly fascinating being on the receiving end of a story, because I never really know what someone's going to share, but it always surprises me in some way. And for me, I'm just grateful that people take the time to talk. And it's interesting now as a reporter and as an editor, this is sort of the bread and butter of what I do with a lot of my days. And so it felt like this really amazing training ground for learning about people, and I'm still learning every day and try to, you know, approach this issue and other issues with humility and sensitivity and just the sense that everyone has something to teach me if only I take the time to listen to it.
Yeah, I've been reporting about sustainability and climate change for longer than I care to admit, a long, long time. And I think halfway through I realized you can't really change people on an individual basis. But what I admire about your story is that even though you might not hope for that at an individual one-on-one level, you're still hopeful on a larger level. But I wonder if you feel like on that larger level that your generation, since you started the project 2014 to now, if your generation has become more awake and aware about the climate change issue, and if you feel like it's not your generation that you have to worry about, but it's ours or another one, I'd like to hear that as well.
Yeah, well, I am really amazed at the climate activism that's come out of even just the last year with Greta Thunberg and her contemporaries around the world. Just looking at the map of School Strike for the Climate and seeing the hundreds, if not thousands, of places where young people are standing up to the powers that be and saying that this is a climate crisis and a climate emergency, and that no, we're not going to go to school while you don't do anything to address these problems, these changes. So yeah, I think there has been kind of a tidal wave of activism recently, and I am hopeful that translates more directly into solutions that kind of, rather than reaffirming the status quo, take the time and care to bring in the voices and experiences and needs of people who aren't often a part of the conversation about solutions, and to forefront those marginalized voices of women and people of color, and make sure that any solutions are just and equitable.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the people you met, maybe in the Central Asian republics? What are they concerned about over there?
Yeah, I think drinking water supply is a huge concern, I mean, worldwide. But even just over the river in New Jersey here, we have kind of terrifying stories of water contamination for kids right now. So it's close to home. But also in Kazakhstan, I was there for an Innovation and Ideas Festival last summer in 2018 called Go Viral. And I was kind of giving talks throughout it. And on the last day, a man who is about my age came up to me and kind of spoke in broken English. He was saying that he had a story that he wanted to share, but he wanted to tell me without a translator and an interpreter, just so that I could hear and listen and understand. And he told a story about growing up in Afghanistan and how he and his younger brother were inside a house. I think it was the winter, and because there was no running water where they were living, they had to source water from the river and boil it inside so that it was safe to drink. And somehow over the course of that day, the bucket of water kind of toppled over and ended up really fatally burning his younger brother. And he said that he felt kind of this huge responsibility and that he had failed his brother somehow, that had taken this, you know, really awful, awful story that happened to him and is now trying to create more solutions to water filtration and things like that in Central Asia so that no one else has to lose a family member to not having clean water. I think he said it really, really beautifully, that if the water had been safe to drink, that his brother would still be there today. So that was, I mean, one of the most difficult ones to listen to, but it was so, so powerful. And after that, he thanked me and he said he'd never shared that story before.
Wow.
It just felt, and he said it felt good to talk about it. So I hope that, you know, sometimes just something as simple as wearing a cardboard sign and creating the opportunity for people to share stories can be, you know, maybe even on an individual level, a form of reflection and healing and just taking the time to make space for one another.
Yeah. So now you have done all these extensive travels to places that many of us may never go, and now you're in New York, and I'm wondering how that has changed your perception or what insights you have about bicycling, just to bring it back to bicycling, because this is a bike show. Now that you're in New York, do you ride your bike, or what do you think when you're out on the streets and you see the amount of people biking, and how does that affect you?
Yeah, I mean, I think like anywhere in the States, pretty much the bike infrastructure could be a lot better. Mm-hmm. But I am definitely enjoying the Hudson River Bikeway. And earlier this summer, did kind of a longer ride up and into New Jersey with some friends, which was super fun. And I just couldn't stop smiling the whole time, even when I got home and my legs were so sore because I hadn't done it in a while. So I definitely am trying to bring more of that into my life. But for me, it just reinforces that the bike is this tool for joy. And no matter where I am or what's going on, it's just such this great, like, refreshing reset button for you know, kind of moving through air. This aspect of balance I can't quite put into words, but and it can be hard to find that sort of serenity and calm in the city. I've been finding it more lately through running, just because my work schedule is quite intense, and so it can be easier to lace up my shoes and just run out the door in the morning quick before going to the office. But I definitely want to make more space and time for longer weekend rides, because there's some sort of flow state in it that I can get through writing as well, but it's so satisfying and so beautiful to move through the world in that way. And you know, future time that I have where it's longer chunks of not working in the office, I definitely hope to be back on the bike saddle before too long, because it is so much fun.
Our show has zoomed by, I don't know how, but we have a few minutes, and I'm wondering, you're also a poet. If you have a poem handy and you feel like sharing, please do. If not, we'll ask you something else. But if you have a poem.
I regret to say that I do not have one prepared for right now, but I would be happy to answer any more questions.
Okay.
Okay. I do have a question. So I would love it if you wanted to reiterate now how you're going to do the last 150 stories or the next segment of stories of the 1001 Stories Project.
Yeah, so part of it is that I am welcoming any contributions that people have to share if they want to kind of record their own voice. And either there's on the 1001stories.org website, there's a kind of phone number or email address where you can either call and leave a voice message or just share a story via emailing a voice recording. So that's one option.
Okay.
Other ways, I don't know. I'm not beyond, I've still been kind of just like settling into the sedentary lifestyle here. But I might go back out walking around New York with the sign on, because it's sort of how I started, and it's delightful and weird full circle to be back here. I'll be going to Antarctica with the National Science Foundation in November of next year, and
okay.
That will be, I think, a 6-week round trip, mostly spending time at McMurdo Base. So collect some stories there, and beyond that, you know, I'm still figuring it out, but part of it will be on the bike for sure, because it's just an honor to how this started, but it's a work in progress.
Yeah.
Well, Devi, it's been a pleasure and an honor. We have been speaking with Devi Lockwood. Thank you for being on the show. All the best with your future projects, and may your work help increase awareness of all the threats facing humanity and the many creative ways that people can and will act to stop the rising waters. So thank you so much. And of course, if you ever make it to Portland, it's not Antarctica, but if you make it to Portland, of course, there are people, and if I could speak for myself, who would be happy to welcome you into our home. So all the best to you.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor and a pleasure, and hope you all have happy trails ahead.
Thanks.
Thanks. In the second half of the show, we will be joined by poet Matthias Svalina, creator of the Dream Delivery Service.
Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studio in Portland, Oregon, 90.7. In the studio are myself, April Streeter, and Alon Rab. And now in the second half of the show, we're happy to have as our guest Matthias Svalina, creator of what is called the Dream Delivery Service. He's combined his skills of writing short, surrealistic fiction poems, I kind of think of them as stream of consciousness, with riding his bicycle throughout the part of the night. Good morning, Matthias, and welcome to our show.
Hi.
Hi.
And good.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Yeah. Good morning. Did you work last night? Are we catching you after a busy night? And
oh yeah, I've been up since 2 a.m. here in Boise, and I have about a five-hour bike delivery route in the mornings here. So I've already biked around town and delivered dreams, and then I've been sitting and writing dreams since then.
Okay, so we're getting you almost at the end of your day. What time do you have to go to bed at night to wake up in the middle of the night for dream delivery?
I end up in bed around 8 or 9.
Okay. Wow, you don't get all that much sleep.
I'm one of those people.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Alon.
Before we talk about the Dream Delivery Service, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your own background. Where did you grow up? Were bicycles and riding always an important part of your life?
Mm-hmm. I grew up pretty much in the suburbs around different cities, around Chicago, around New Orleans, around D.C. And as a kid, bicycling was freedom. You know, and it was the only way to sort of get out of my neighborhood, to get out of that sort of closed-in space of the suburbs. And when I became a teenager and the car culture of the suburbs kind of settled in with me, I didn't bike for years and years. Hmm. And it wasn't until my mid-20s that I came back to biking and started just commuting when I lived in Richmond, Virginia, which is a great biking town, and commuting when I lived in Lincoln, Nebraska. And then it wasn't until I moved into Brooklyn that I got rid of my car entirely, and that was, I think, 2006 or 2007. And I started just living off my bike in Brooklyn and in Denver. And mostly, though, I wasn't doing any sort of long distance riding or touring or anything really radical. I was mostly just kind of using it as primary form of transportation.
Hmm. And then No, I was going to say that. So that kind of summarizes your biking life. And I'm wondering, mm-hmm, your life as a poet, or do you consider yourself a poet first or a writer first? And yeah.
Most of the books that I have published are poetry, so I guess I'm a poet.
Okay.
When it comes to genre distinctions, I usually don't care.
Okay, because it seems to me that poet is a job description and a career choice these days that has extremely low earning ability. And so it
would it's somewhere between monastic vocation and career.
Yeah.
And so I thought you earn poets earn as much as CEOs of tech companies.
No.
I guess I was mistaken. Yeah.
So I would love to hear about when you decided that, okay, if I am, or I don't know, maybe you have a story about it. If I am going to be a poet, here's how I have to make that life work as far as feeding myself.
I was pretty much going along a path of trying to be an academic for years, and I had gone to grad school and PhD school, and I was teaching poetry as a part-timer in Denver, Colorado, and teaching in Boulder at the University of Colorado. But I started the Dream Delivery Service because I was broke.
Yeah.
I had plans for teaching over a summer period that fell through at the last minute, and I realized that I had nothing set up and that my only skill set was writing weird stuff for people. So I came up with the Dream Delivery Service to combine the kind of writing that I do, which is often very serial, surrealist narratives. Kind of, my first book is 44 creation myths. My second book is 44 surrealist business plans. And I tend to write in these sort of repetitive modes like that.
Okay.
So I combined that with biking, and it ended up somehow becoming my whole life.
Wow.
And the number 44, any particular significance?
No. Nah.
It's just what it was. Just what happened.
Just a number.
And so when you first started out with the Dream Delivery Service, was it the same as it is now? And then describe the structure a little bit, and if there's been a change over time of how you've organized it in order to work for you.
It's a lot of it's exactly how I thought of it the first day that I thought of it.
Okay.
Which is, I take subscribers, and every day for a month I write little dreams, and then I bike around before dawn and leave those dreams in people's doors.
Okay.
And then for people who subscribe outside of the town that I'm in, I mail them every day. So that was 2013, and I thought I was just going to do it once. I ended up liking the process a lot and getting interest from places to do it with other institutions or do it in other towns. So I also, around that time, doing the sort of long bike routes that I was doing every day for delivery taught me that I could bike 40, 50 miles a day and feel perfectly wonderful. So that kind of led me to doing long-distance touring, and I did a two-month trip down the West Coast and fell in love with that lifestyle and figured if I could combine the two and do a month in a city on the road and then be on the road camping and in the wild for a month, that I could travel around the country for a couple of years and write and bike.
Wow.
And live off of that.
And how do these subscribers find you?
I have no idea. I have a little website, dreamdeliveryservice.com, that people come to. In some cities, I'm in Boise, Idaho right now, and a local literary organization, SEMA, which brings in writers and runs workshops, have been hosting me. I'm the artist in residence for the month, so they've been helping me to get the word out, and the Arts Weekly in town wrote a little story about me. So as I travel around, in some cities I get that kind of help from locals, and in some cities I'm doing it totally DIY and just putting up posters in coffee shops and cold calling the newspaper, and hopefully somebody
gets interested,
notices that I'm there.
So the itinerant lifestyle that you have of moving from city to city, that was more something that you took on. It was a decision that you made because you enjoy the move from place to place. So it wasn't really so much economically driven, but more like environmentally driven by the love of being outdoors and changing the landscape pretty frequently.
it's more of that environmental issue and that itinerancy. Also, I knew that I couldn't do this in such a way that I felt comfortable with of making enough money to keep a stable household and mm-hmm. such. So if I was going to do it, I had to be all in. And but more than that, I think it's that love of bike camping and bike touring and that participation with the environment and the participation with the landscape and the area that I found with biking that I just never had before.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. what kind of bike are you using, and are you do you constantly have a setup of bike camping gear with that bike?
Oh, yeah. I've got my gear on me all the time. I basically have everything I own.
Okay.
On my bike or in a little box that I ship forward from city to city.
Wow.
I have a long-haul trucker now, which is lovely. I miss my 85 Raleigh Kodiak that I bought off Craigslist for $100, and it was a great 80s touring bike, but I ended up having a weird fall in the West Texas desert and bending the frame and cold setting it back out with a 2x4, and
wow.
That spot on the frame cracked after about, I think, 30,000 miles of just my miles on it in 3 years. So who knows how many miles I've had since 1985.
Hmm. Pretty cool. So you don't consider yourself having a home base city?
Denver is kind of my home base that I return to when I need to get off the road or need to regroup.
You are listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon. We are speaking with Matthias Valina, creator of the Dream Delivery Service. Do you have, by chance, any of these dreams or any of your own poetry that you could share with our listeners?
Sure. I've got a handful of dreams here. Maybe I could read one and see.
That'd be great.
Mm-hmm.
So the dreams don't really have anything to do with biking.
That's fine.
But they do sort of collect their imagery from the time that I'm biking every day. I think that depending on the city I'm in, I bike around for 3 to 5 hours every morning, and through that time I kind of recharge with the landscape and stuff. Just this morning I passed by a guy at 4 a.m. who was spinning around slowly in a circle, shaking bird seed out of a bag all around him in the dark before the birds were awake, and I instantly knew that was going to go into a dream sometime. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But this is one that I wrote when I was in Denver that directly came out of an image that I saw when I was biking around. You're standing on a street corner, pretending to be a tree. Some people walking by say things like, "What a beautiful tree," and you're happy that you've tricked them into thinking you really are a tree. Some people walking by say things like, "Look at how good that kid is at being a tree." You're less happy, but still happy about that. Some of the people walking by don't say anything, though. And eventually, you get tired of being a tree, and you pretend to be a bookshelf. A person walking by stops and looks at all the books on your shelves. They say, and consider picking up one book, but then change their mind. Then they say, again, and a third time. Finally, they pick a book out of one of your shelves. They stand there and read the book for a few minutes. They are made so happy by the book. They put the book back onto your shelf and walk away. You stop pretending to be a bookshelf, but you save the book the person was reading so you can read it too. When you open the book, it smells like dirt. Not dirty, not a bad smell, but like dirt in a garden, dark and rich and full of life.
Nice. I like it. What do you do about winter?
mostly try to get south.
Okay.
Last November and December, from mid-November to mid-December, I was in Boulder, Colorado, which is pretty temperate. But I did have days that I couldn't deliver because of ice on the road.
Mm.
And I don't have the tires set up for being safe on the ice in the middle of the night.
Mm. And I think I read on your site that you charge more for nightmares. Is that
I do?
And why is that? I mean, it seems like, you know, every time I open the newspaper, there are enough nightmares to drive me crazy. So why are nightmares? Are they harder to write? Or
well, I first did it as a joke. because I think it was the second time I did the dream delivery service at all, and I just added that, and as I was putting the website together, thinking that A, no one would actually want nightmares, and B, no one would spend a little bit more money on them, since obviously I'm doing the same work.
Yeah.
But about, you know, 4 to 10 people a month that I do it order nightmares, and it turns out they are harder to write because nightmares are mostly pretty cliche. Right? There are actual nightmares of, you know, people chasing us or our teeth falling out or you're trying to teach a class but you have no pants on, you know, these.
Yeah.
So I feel like I can never fall back into those trite nightmare tropes or horror movie tropes that are actually the most common nightmares. So when I'm writing dreams, it's always sort of a really open-ended and exploratory and improvisatory experience of just kind of what happens next and what can be made exciting or interesting or funny or silly or profound or wonderful out of the random chance of whatever happens next. But writing nightmares, everything has to close down into some kind of anxiety or terror or fear. So it closes down the sort of joyful, improvisatory element of writing the dreams. So I'm glad I don't have to write as many every day.
So then I guess you would say that overall the dream delivery is a way to give people some kind of joyful or hopeful or open-ended future feeling.
I think so. I'm not sure I would phrase it that way because that sounds a little too proud.
Okay.
I feel like I'm writing a book with an individual reader over the course of the month because everybody gets a unique set and the thing doesn't happen on any single day. Like, no single one of them, I think, are really great unto themselves, but over 30 or 31 days and the range of it, and some of them are sad and some of them are funny and some of them are nonsensical and some of them are boring. Yeah, over that period of time and that duration of working with a reader, I feel like something interesting can happen that doesn't happen with writing a book or somebody reading a book.
Hmm. So would you say there's a narrative arc to the month then of some sort?
I don't think I have the organizational skills to pull off a real narrative arc. It's more like I sit down every day and write whatever the heck comes to mind.
Yeah.
So I wish I was more logistical and could sort of track images over the month for people and, you know, develop themes or something, but it's more immediate and ephemeral.
Cool.
And how do these dreams interact with the other writing you do, the poetry? Do you have time, energy to write other things, or are you exhausted in the morning? Or
I have written far less over the last, since I started doing the dream delivery service. I've both written far more than I ever have before, because I'll write 1,000 or 1,200 of these a month.
Wow.
But then I don't save them for books, and I don't want to make books out of them. So the writing that I do that takes a lot of slower process and more sort of considered work, I don't have the time or mindset for as much. So I'm finding that I need to take months off where I can seclude myself just for writing, because I write so much that I don't have time to write.
Yeah. I'm curious as why you don't want to make them into books. And then a little adjunct question to that is, do you archive them anywhere?
I don't want to make them into books because I like them being an ephemeral project. Mm-hmm. I like that, you know, and I think this is all caught up with the biking part of it too. Like, I like that I'm slipping through the neighborhoods in the night, and there's a kind of, you know, fable element even to that, where I'm trying to be a weird postmodern tooth fairy or something. And
cool.
But I like them being just this thing, and not the project not being a sort of stand-in for bigger thing later or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I used to delete all of them until I switched to this being my only form of income.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I was contacting museums and institutions around the country and sort of saying, like, I do this thing, and I've gotten some good press, and people like it. And then they asked for examples, and I was like, oh, no, I deleted them all.
Oh, yeah.
And they were a little suspicious of me at that point.
Okay.
So I've been trying to save one from every day of every month that I do it, and I make little, basically zines, kind of just homemade chapbook kind of things that I'll have as when I do events in towns, just to have a sort of example of what I do so people know what they're getting.
Okay, it's time for the all-important question, Alon. It's right there. I'm waiting for you to ask it.
Why pink envelopes?
That's the one. Why pink envelopes?
It's my favorite color.
Oh.
And I look terrible in pink because I have a pink complexion already. So I love anything that's pink, but I can't wear any pink because I look weird in it. So anytime I get a chance of using a color for anything, I always want a soft pastel pink.
That is awesome.
And, yeah, nothing deep.
Nothing deep.
I don't know about postmodern, but actually when I first heard of your project, I was reminded of some early stories of Borges, except over there maybe the person writing becomes part of the dream or a nightmare. But I'm wondering about your own nighttime dreams. When you're asleep, what if it's not too private, what do you dream about? And maybe I'm being invasive, so excuse me. But
no, I wish I had an interesting answer, but I'm so anxiety riddled that all my dreams are just really standard issue anxiety dreams where I'm just letting people down, I've done the wrong thing.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So my subconscious is incredibly boring, so hopefully my imagination makes up for it a little bit.
That's fascinating that you found that. I guess I'd never really had come to the conclusion that our dream lives are so boring, but when you describe it, especially the nightmares and kind of the repetitive nature of these anxieties that come to the fore, it does seem pretty boring after a little while. But we're always fascinated
the scary
by
parts are the boring parts.
Yeah.
You know, the transcendent parts and the sublime parts are, you know, are usually so hard to convey. Like, I think the one dream I have that I really cherish as a memory is just being in the ocean and looking up and seeing a whale swim over me. And it is as close to a spiritual experience as I've had in my life. But it's also not describable because it's a transcendent experience. It's a metaphysical experience. So I feel like the dreams that are interesting are the ones that in which the least happens, but the most feeling happens. And that's what I'm always sort of chasing when I'm writing these, is trying to get enough narrative in there so that there's a sequence of events for somebody to get onto, but also kind of pointing toward some sense of the sublime or some sense of something wonderful.
So I think that you answered one of the questions that we have, which was, did you think you'll ever run out of this stream of consciousness or ability to write the dreams? But it sounds like if you're grappling with how to convey the transcendent, then you won't, or unless you figure out a solution of an easy way to explain the transcendent.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like in many ways I'm doing an atheistic kind of a mystical thing, and I'm chasing this, you know, indescribable and ineffable. So and because of my writing habits and the way that writing makes me just on a personal level feel good in the act of writing, I think people are going to be bored of me before I run out of things to write in this.
Do you have any sense of who these subscribers are, or does it even matter?
I get between somewhere between 30 and 70 subscribers per city usually. And I usually need about 40 or so to economically get through the month, and then I usually have a month off that I'm traveling, and so I have a little bit of a fan base from my writing career. So a chunk usually comes from people who are familiar with me as a writer, And then the remainder usually come from people who have heard of me from, you know, the radio or heard of me from Arts Weeklies or word of mouth, and are would never have subscribed if I was writing a poem delivery service. But because I'm writing a dream delivery service, and because I have this lifestyle of doing it by bike and sort of being committed in this way, I think they're interested in what I'm doing and interested in having this sort of experience they can have for a month that, I don't know, I don't think that anyone else is doing this.
No. Well, not at least that we've heard of, and certainly not delivered by bike, although now that the show's out there, maybe we'll get the other bike delivery services of this nature that will come and say, oh, I do that.
Maybe.
Yeah, and I think Alon had this as a question, which I found fascinating. Have you ever thought of going outside of the U.S. to do a dream delivery?
I have. Right now, it's just kind of the economics of it that I'm usually pretty much breaking even, and I like it that way.
Yeah.
I have had artist friends and who are telling me that I should be charging a lot more, but I like charging as little as I can, as long as I still get by, because I want it to not be a collectible or some sort of thing that only a handful of people who hear about it and have an interest in investing in a sort of arts thing will do. But for, you know, it's maybe a lot of money, but it's the price of like 3 books maybe. Mm-hmm. So people who are interested for the most part can afford it. Mm-hmm. So I would love to go through Europe, mostly because I want to bike across Europe and this would be a way to do it.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, it's probably hard to pay with goodwill and thanks at the grocery store, but it's clear listening to you that your payment is the joy you bring, you know, people, the goodness you add to the world, your creativity. Those can't be measured, you know, in the bank, but of course you still need to.
I like all those things more than money.
Yeah.
Well, our time is almost up, so if it's okay with you, maybe you could leave us with either one of your own poems or another dream. So,
I only have dreams in front of me. I'll end with a short little surrealist dream.
That'd be great.
I don't know why I said surrealist. They're all kind of surreal. all right, this one. You're driving home. The landscape is a monotone of gray and beige, a dry dead land, an artificial used land. You can't wait to get home. You begin to chant, home, home, home. You slap your hand against the dashboard as you chant, home, home. You pump your fist. You feel silly. It's silly, but it's a good feeling. You're alone in the car, and no one can make you feel anything but the feeling you're feeling. There are times like this when the whole of you is right there in your body, when you see a strange splash of green suddenly on the side of the road, where everything else had been gray and beige. You slow down to look more closely. It's the telephone poles. They are sprouting new leaves, new branches. The dead things, the things we have killed and built upon, they're coming back to life.
Wow, that one was awesome. Thank you so much, Matthias. I really liked it.
Thank you, and all the best to you. And again, if you ever make it to Portland, Oregon, please look us up.
I will.
Thanks. You have been listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon, available online at kbo.fm and also 90.7 FM. All shows are available as podcasts at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com, as well as on iTunes. My name is Alon Rab, and I would like to thank our guests, Davey Lockwood and Matthias Svalina, whose work adds beauty, creativity, and a measure of humility and sustainability to our lives. You could find links to their projects on our show's website. Thank you also to my co-host, April Streeter, to our engineer, Claire Risciotto, to our web host, Chris Smith. Tori, I hope you are having wonderful adventures, and I hope we all join in the climate strike on September 20th. All the best to all our listeners, and have safe and joyful rides.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11:59. But first, this from KBOO.
Process, starting with Iowa, first in the nation. The Iowa Democratic Party has a problem. For those who don't know, the caucuses take place on an often brutally cold February evening, and they last hours. This isn't doable for everyone. In 2016, the caucus turnout was just 15.7%, and the Democratic National Committee is now mandating caucuses be more accessible. The Iowa Democratic Party proposed a telecaucus, where people could phone in their candidate preferences. Nevada, another early caucus state, planned to have something similar, but the DNC has decided that both Iowa and Nevada must look for a new solution to low turnout.
The caucus, you have motions, you have debate, and there's no way to carry that out in the proposed telecaucus. The wheeling and dealing that goes on in a caucus is a very real thing, which causes people to take into account political considerations, which you don't do in just stepping into a polling booth, checking off a box on your ballot.
University of Iowa computer science professor Douglas Jones agrees with the DNC. He co-chaired an Iowa City caucus in the last election and studies election security. More on that later. But despite the historical low turnout and the DNC's new directive, modern Iowa caucuses are more inclusive than they once were. In our Ames studio, KHOI's Ursula Rudenberg went back in time with Richard Bender to talk about his part in forming the modern Iowa caucuses. While the Vietnam War was raging in 1968, there was a close vote on an anti-war plank of the party platform, but it was shut out by local caucus leadership. Then, anti-war delegates were maneuvered out of the state convention.
That was not viewed as very fair. And that created quite a bit of anger. Similar events had happened in Woodbury County and at Wapello County in earlier years. This was not